Before we start, if you're enjoying these conversations, please make sure that you like, subscribe, and leave a review or comment for Cleaning Up. It really helps other people to find us. Also, subscribe to us on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. And follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Instagram, where you can watch highlights from each episode, read my takeaways, and keep up with all things cleaning up. And finally, don't forget to visit cleaningup.live, where you can access over 150 hours of conversations with extraordinary climate leaders, and you can subscribe to our free newsletter. That's all on cleaningup.live. Now, let's get started. Cleaning Up is brought to you by our lead supporter, Capricorn Investment Group, the Liebreich Foundation, and the Gilardini Foundation. Hello, I'm Michael Liebreich, and this is Cleaning Up. My guest today is Emily Kirsch, founder and CEO of Powerhouse, based out of Oakland, California. Powerhouse describes itself as an innovation firm that pairs climate technology startups with some of the world's largest corporations and investors. Emily is also managing partner of Powerhouse Ventures, which makes investments directly in seed stage climate technology startups. Please join me in welcoming Emily Kirsch to Cleaning Up. So Emily, thank you so much for joining us here today on Cleaning Up.
Of course, Michael. Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here, especially because you generously joined us on our podcast, What It Takes, back in April of 2021. So I'm happy to be here.
Well, I think you were generous to have me on your great show. And, you know, let's start with the plug, right? What is your podcast? Tell us the name and where to find it. We'll come back to why you do it in a second.
Sounds great. Thank you. So What It Takes is our podcast, Watt Like a Kilowatt, so WATT. And we feature founders of some of the most innovative companies in the climate tech space, and they tell the personal journey of how they built their businesses, but also how they became who they are. So for your listeners who want to hear all about your childhood and how that shaped you, I encourage them to check out What It Takes with Michael Liebreich.
Well, I am such a damaged person who has to try and my revenge now on all these awful people, these awful entrepreneurs who are more successful than me. So then we got that bit done. Everybody's got a podcast. Yours is What It Takes, and it is brilliant. And not my episode, obviously, but the sort of people you will come back and talk about it a bit more. But give the full sort of thumbnail of yourself in your own words. What is it that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's two entities. So there's Powerhouse, which is a company, and then Powerhouse Ventures, a venture fund. And the company works with leading corporations, and we connect them to startups that have the technology that those corporations and corporate venture capital arms are looking to become a customer of or invest in or acquire. So we basically connect the two sides of the ecosystem, big players, energy, tech, utilities, to startups who they both want to find each other. We make it efficient and effective for them to collaborate. So that's the company. And then Powerhouse Ventures is a seed stage software focused climate tech fund. We're backed by some of the world's largest energy, automotive, utility, financial services, property tech, and tech companies, along with a bunch of great family offices in the US and then a whole bunch of individuals. And one of the things I'm most proud of is that Powerhouse Ventures is women founded. We're women led, it's a majority women team, and the majority of the individual investors in Powerhouse Ventures are industry leaders who are women, which I think is an industry first.
Now, both parts of that, Powerhouse and Powerhouse Ventures, they're both focused on climate. You said that about Powerhouse Ventures.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't say that about Powerhouse, but it's all around climate. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I should have said that. It's so in my blood that sometimes I forget because I'm like, of course it is. But yes, you're exactly right.
And define for us, when you say, you know, when we talk about climate, some people would say, well, that's mainly energy and hard infrastructure and transport. And some people go, oh, no, it's agriculture and it's, you know, it's the carbon cycle and the oceans as well. How broad is climate in your your definition?
Great question. And you're exactly right. I mean, there's so many solutions to address the climate crisis, including food and ag and water solutions. But in our case, it is really focused on energy, the automotive sector. And so when we work with clients like Google, who's one of our customers, their focus is achieving 24/7 carbon-free energy. So 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every electron they consume is from a clean carbon-free source. So that's one of the projects that we've engaged with them, connecting them to startups that have the solutions that can help them achieve that goal. And then other clients like Enel, the Italian-based utility, which has deployed more renewables than any utility in the world. We've done everything from autonomous solar O&M to turbine de-icing to infrastructure risk solutions. So those are just a couple of examples of the types of climate solutions that we're able to bring to these massive tech companies, energy companies, utilities that want to embrace and adopt those solutions.
So I was once told, actually by my strategy professor at Harvard Business School, that if you don't say no to things, you don't really have a strategy.
Yes.
So have you ever said no? Have you said, look, we're just not the right people, or that's not climate? Can you think of an example?
Oh, yeah. I mean, many, and we've gotten better at this. I think when you're earlier in your offering, you just want to do everything for everyone and say yes to every project. And we learned the hard way that that is not the right way to do it. We did a couple projects, one focused on, you know, connected worker or the future of work. And it had some ties to the climate space, but it was really not our area of expertise. And client wasn't happy and we weren't happy. And so yeah, things that are outside of our area of expertise, we don't do. And if there are certain products or services that a client might want, if they want us to spin up their own corporate venture capital arm, there are entities that do that. We don't. You know, our job is we connect you to deal flow. We do workshops. We do trend analysis. We do top of the funnel startup management. But we know what we're really good at, and we know what's going to make a client happy. And our NPS score is 80, which is world class. And we want to keep it that way by saying yes to stuff we're good at and let others do the things that we're not.
Now, you're going to have to explain. We have a rule here, which I forgot to brief you on before this.
I can imagine the acronym rule.
It's the acronym Klaxon. So I'm sorry. What is an NPS score?
That's good. And yeah, you can hit the button anytime I forget. Net Promoter Score. So this is the idea of, for your customers or clients, how likely are they to promote you to their peers and colleagues? And so anything 75 and above, world class, as good as it gets. And so the fact that ours is 80 is something that we're really proud of.
Oh, that now that makes me really worry, because I've never found out what my NPS is.
And, oh, you got to find out.
It could be very high, because I might have sort of, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, sort of pissed off all the people who don't like me. So they're not like, they don't listen. So then I get a very good loyalty amongst those who do.
Exactly. It's all about the data sample you're pulling from.
Yeah, it might be a biased sample. Maybe there's a way of adjusting for that. Okay. But let's go back to those two different pieces and talk about them separately, because you've dived in, you've talked about some of the services that I'm guessing those are generally things that you're providing, because they didn't sound like venture capital. So they're presumably through the powerhouse part of the business. So slow down and take us through those services that you provide, because I think, you know, we get the idea there's a bunch of kind of coaching and informational type services, and then there's an investment piece, which I think probably most of my audience would understand a bit better. So let's start with the difficult stuff.
Yeah. And you're exactly right. The venture fund, pretty straightforward in terms of its structure. You know, we can dive into thesis. Whereas the company is unique. There's nothing quite like Powerhouse. So the foundation of our services is the same across all of the products. And the foundation is a database of thousands of climate tech startups that we've built over the past 6 or so years. So we think it's the country, if not the world's most comprehensive database of climate tech startups. The data comes directly from them. So we're not scraping what we can find publicly on their website or from Crunchbase or PitchBook. You know, the fundraising data, the technology information, it comes from the founders directly, and they share it with us because they know that we're going to use it to make introductions to potential customers and investors on their behalf for free to them.
Okay, now I've got to dive in because I'm a data guy, and I started New Energy Finance by building a database of startups. And, and in my case, the where it actually started, and some people who listen to these shows will find it funny because they've heard me on hydrogen, but it started with hydrogen and fuel cells. And it was classic tech startups initially, but it was global. And there were some in Malaysia and there were some in Bulgaria, and it was hard to find, but we got it. You know, that's what we did. Is yours just US? Is it global? And how tightly is it just tech? You know, what's the boundary?
Yeah, it is about 60-40 U.S. international, and the rate of increase in international is higher than that of the companies in the U.S., which is interesting. So 60-40 U.S. international, and then about a third, pure hardware, pure software. And then the remaining third is a combination of both. And that is also increasing because, as you can imagine, you don't have one without the other. So yeah, 50-50 hardware, software, 60-40 US international.
What about the split? One of the things, and you know, you were going back to 2004, 5, 6, 7, this was my life, trying to train people to distinguish between, for instance, you know, we expanded quite quickly from hydrogen and fuel cells and started to do solar, started to do biofuels, et cetera. But how do you distinguish between somebody who's got a, it might be a next generation biofuels technology and somebody who's building a plant? Because the person building a plant's not really a startup in the same way as somebody who says they've got this fantastic enzyme.
Right. Yeah. So we do, to your point on stage, we track every stage. So from pre-seed, and it's not even publicly known yet, to public companies. But most of the companies in the database are at that seed, Series A, maybe Series B, in part because that's where we can add the most value. If you're already Series B or beyond, our clients can find you. You know, our clients don't need us.
But it's not just a question of stage, because you can have, you know, somebody could have, you know, the magic enzyme and it goes through pre-seed, seed, Series A, Series B, Series C. But separately, there'll be a bunch of people taking that enzyme and starting up, you know, some cellulosic ethanol, sustainable airline fuel project. And this, the reason it's an interesting question is because that's one of the, that's one of the really difficult fault lines between these physical technologies, hard tech, that then has to go off and get embodied in assets. And we kind of have two financing systems. We got a financing system for tech, and we got a financing system for infrastructure, but we don't have a financing system for where the two are sort of the gears are grinding.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great point. And in terms of what is in the database, it is not, you know, lab kind of our early R&D, these are startups. So every company in the database, you know, maybe a few minor exceptions, but everyone in the database, it is an incorporated company. And then in terms of what we find and spend our time digging into, that's based on what our clients want. So, you know, Google, Enel, Black & Veatch, DNV, FRV, like these are all clients of ours. And based on what they tell us they're interested in, that's what determines who we go out and first look within the database, who do we already know, but then also go out and do the research and find the other companies so that we can give them a comprehensive landscape of here's everyone you need to be aware of. If you're interested in this kind of tech, these are the startups that you need to know about, and we'll help connect you to them and help you filter who is a best fit for what you're looking for.
Right. But the focus is very much on the tech and not the asset is what I'm hearing.
Generally right.
Like it's at the core of the service, you've got the database. How many entries have you got? How many companies?
Nearly 7,000. We add about 600 every quarter because that's how many we're finding and how many are being created, which that in and of itself is pretty incredible. And our value prop to our clients is you can't possibly keep up with all of them. That's not your job to, but that is our job. So let us make your life easier by doing that comprehensive analysis, pull from every incubator, accelerator, prize competition, DOE grant, you know, LPO loan, and package that and make that quickly accessible for clients.
And who do you come up against sort of competition? Is this Lux Capital's type work? Is this, we had Gina Demarnik, Emerald Technology Ventures from Zurich, who, you know, she didn't talk about the database, but I know I'm an advisor there and I know she's got one and it's huge. Are those the sort of people? Is there anybody else? Or is it more the kind of pure data players, the kind of Venture Source, Venture One, whatever they're called now?
Yeah, there's a couple different categories. And it's worth mentioning, while I've talked about the database and I'm very proud of it, this isn't a SaaS product. We don't sell direct access to it. It's what we use internally as the foundation for more consulting-based work based on what the client wants. And when we do the NPS, the Net Promoter Score interviews, we're asking, what do you value most? And it's not that, oh, I want to just go in the database. It's the conversations with our expert team of, you know, PhD physicists and battery chemists who are helping them evaluate these technologies and understand the market. So in terms of competition, a couple categories. One is people compare us to incubators and accelerators, which we used to be way back in the day, which we can talk about. And our response there is they're great. They play a really important role, but they're just inherently limited by the number of companies they can fit in their physical space or in their cohort-based program if it's an accelerator, whereas we pull from all of them. So we're going to see everything they see and so much more. So that's the incubator and accelerator group. The other group that you mentioned are more kind of generalist consultants, maybe with some climate focus, some without. but entities that do help CVCs spin up or help them operate. And our response there is
Klaxon CVCs.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Corporate venture capital arm. So for corporations who want to set up venture arms that are either directly tied or indirectly tied to their operations, CVCs, corporate venture capital. So that's the second big category. It's kind of generalist consultants. And our argument there is they might be great. They're not going to know climate the way we do. So if your focus is decarbonization and innovation in that space, we're going to be better. And then the last group you mentioned is just database services, Crunchbase, PitchBook. And similarly, they're great, but the data is not going to be as accurate because they're not getting it directly from founders and they're not climate specific. So if you search managed charging in Crunchbase, for example, you might find, I don't know, a handful of companies. In our database, there's maybe 30 or so. So just to give an example of how that's different.
This is fabulous for me. It's a real sort of walk down memory lane because this is how I started New Energy Finance. Very interestingly, we made the decision, partly because I come from a publishing background, it was a SaaS product. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. you know, right at the beginning, actually with my co-founder, Bozkurt Aydinoglu, who came out of venture capital, he wanted to raise a fund. I didn't know how to do that, but I did know how to sell, you know, business information services. And so we built it very much as something that other people could then interrogate. But then we discovered, I think was also what you've discovered, is that people don't really pay for raw data. They don't pay much. They pay for insight and they pay for instructions.
Right.
They pay
Exactly. Yeah.
So what are your services? How do you then serviceize? How have you productized? Yeah. So that gives you the credibility. It makes you confident. You know, you meet. Yeah. You've got all this information. What are your actual services that you deliver to your clients?
Yeah. So four products. And this is also a little unique. Oftentimes consultants are kind of like, we'll do whatever you want. But as we've talked about, we don't do that. We say, these are the four products. We do them really well. If you sign up for them, you're going to be happy. So four, one is workshops. That's kind of the primary flagship product. And what that means is throughout the course of a year, each quarter, the client selects a topic that they're interested in. It could be, let's say it's managed charging. We come up with a list of, depending on the topic, usually 20 to 60 initial startups based on their criteria. And then we meet with them every 2 weeks to just narrow it down and narrow it down until we have a group of about half a dozen startups that could actually be a source of technology for the client. Or if it's a corporate venture capital arm, if they want to make direct investments, it could be an there could be investment potential with the startup, or it could even be an acquisition target. And we measure ourselves based on outcomes, meaning customer agreements, investments, acquisitions. That's how we know if we've done a good job, is if the client actually decides to partner with a startup. So the workshops are, one topic per quarter, start with a big list of companies, narrow it down. And then we actually bring the startups in to meet directly with the heads of the business units or the heads of the CVC. And then we track those outcomes. So we're not taking it all the way through. We're not investment bankers, you know, enabling transactions, but we are enabling the connections that result in those transactions.
I'm really thrilled, actually, because I heard somebody, there was an investment transaction, £30 million transaction, decent size. And it was somebody who heard about the business because the principal came on cleaning up. And
amazing. I love that. That's the best.
It's always a good feeling. That happened when I was doing New Energy Finance. People came to one of my summits and then created a $1 billion fund. And the first time it happened to me, like, wow, it's working.
Totally. I love that. Yeah. The outcomes from the podcast are the best, like stuff that you just don't know about.
So that's one service, the workshop. Now you've branded these services though. So what's that one called?
Yep. That's Catalyst.
That's Catalyst. Okay. Catalyst is these workshops. Right. What are the other, you've got three to go.
That's right. So the second is Conduit. And Conduit is connecting clients, mostly corporate venture capital firms, to deal flow. So they say, we want to make direct investments into startups. Here's our criteria. Here's what we're looking for. You, powerhouse, tell us who we should know about. And sometimes they get inbounds from startups. I mean, they do all the time. But the question is not, are you getting what's coming to you? It's how is what is coming to you? How does that compare to the entire landscape of what you could have access to if you had the whole picture? So Conduit is deal flow, both based on what the client wants, but we also send them the top 50 startups. So every quarter I mentioned the 600 startups that we add. Of those that are our favorites, we come up with a list of 50, whether it fits the client's criteria or not, because sometimes clients just want to see like, well, what else is out there that we may have not expressed interest in, but if we saw it, we might want to dig in deeper. So they get their list of startups that could be of interest for investment, and they get active deals that we find that we think are interesting. So that's Conduit.
Okay.
And then the last two, one is called Capacitor, and this is top of the funnel management for corporations or CVCs who are just overwhelmed. Like, these are huge corporations, but their CVC teams are usually pretty small and they get inundated with inbounds and they don't always have time to just filter through it and help decide what should actually get in front of the team and what shouldn't. And so we take that burden off their shoulders and we say, send us everything. We love it because it's good for the database. It helps us build our database. And based on their criteria, we filter, we tell them, all right, here are the ones that you should talk to, ignore the rest. So that's Capacitor. And then the last one is called Compass, and that is trend analysis. So because we have all this proprietary data, because it's so accurate, it comes from the founders, it's free to startups, so they're incentivized to share it. We get to do all this interesting data analysis in terms of what sectors are growing most quickly, what's happening with fundraising rounds, you know, our earlier stage or later stage companies in long duration energy storage raising more money and why. So that's a really fun one that kind of gives that, you know, 50,000 foot view relative to things like deal flow of very specific investment opportunities.
Okay, so you've got these four services, and, you know, to me, it's kind of obvious that they're valuable, and our audience is very diverse. You know, we've got everybody from, you know, we've got academics, we've got civic society, we've got, you know, big project investors, we've got some VCs, a lot of policy folks, and, you know, so to some of the audience, it'll be clear why they're so valuable, because this is kind of like, this whole venture process is a bit like dating. You don't know what's out there. You
right.
don't know whether the people you're meeting are, you know, are they the best of the crop, or are they just like,
right.
And so what you're really doing is kind of, it's almost like it's not so much a dating service, but it's almost like structuring the dating services.
Yeah. No, I love it. I love the analogy. I think I never thought of it that way, but now that you say it, that's pretty good.
Well, if you ever want to diversify, then you could probably use the same sort of same software.
Yeah, totally, totally.
Okay. But now when you started yeah. initially, you hadn't structured it. I love these stories about, you know, I love seeing where the mature of the species is this very structured set of services, and I understand yeah. the value prop, but you right. started doing something different.
Yeah.
And then we need to get back to the venture piece as well. But let's now back up. And go back to when you started, which was, I don't know, when was it?
2013. It was 10 years ago.
10 years ago, there's kind of, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, there's young you deciding
yeah.
that you're going to start providing this some kind of a dating service between
right.
Climate tech providers and yeah. climate tech investors. And yeah. how did you go about doing that, and why?
Yeah. And you're exactly right. So it started 10 years ago. And when we started, the business model, completely different. So we were an incubator and accelerator. That was the need that I saw 10 years ago that didn't exist in the San Francisco Bay Area, which blew my mind. Like, global head of venture capital, global head of climate tech innovation. And how does this entity not exist? And I was young and naive enough to say, you know what, I'm just going to try it. I'm probably going to fail, but I'll be happy if I try.
What yeah. were you doing just before? I mean, what was you just woke up one morning, or what, you know, how did things come together and that epiphany yeah. said, I'm going to actually, this is what I'm yeah. going to do?
Let's see. So at the time I was working at a nonprofit organization founded by somebody who's well known in the US, but might not be to all your listeners, named Van Jones. He's mostly does political commentary now on CNN, but also a whole bunch of venture investing in climate and infrastructure. And I worked at the nonprofit organization that he started starting in 2006, and worked on workforce training, local climate policy, state ballot initiatives related to climate solutions. And through that work, had the opportunity to work with a startup. And that was my first exposure to entrepreneurship, was helping them establish their pilot, which was here in Oakland, California, and seeing how much value I could add to them just by knowing who their customers were and connecting them to their initial customers. The light bulb for me was, well, every startup needs connections to customers and connections to capital, and they need community. And so that's when I looked around for months to see if this thing existed, and I couldn't believe that it didn't. And so I think because I was at a nonprofit, I hadn't taken that somewhat traditional path in our space of going to an elite school and working for a consulting agency right out of undergrad and having these golden handcuffs, I was living very cheaply and said, you know what, just let's try it and see what happens.
So you didn't come through, I don't know, environmental
No, I can tell you
background.
For sure the answer.
You don't have the kind of biochemistry from wherever.
MIT.
MIT.
Yeah, no.
No, material science. So you came through a much more, like, was it a social sciences background? Or?
Yeah, well, it was, but so when I went to undergrad, there weren't climate-focused programs. It just didn't exist. And but that's what I wanted. I wanted to study solutions to the climate crisis. And so I was able to create my own major. And this kind of fits into this entrepreneurial journey of just kind of do it yourself, you know, figure it out, experiment mentality that I think I've always had. And so I was able to create a major that looked at things like energy and water and transportation and infrastructure around the world and who's doing it best and why. And so I felt really fortunate to be able to put that program together. And that led me to the work with Van and then the work with the startup and then eventually starting this incubator and accelerator.
And the incubator accelerator, I mean, that's a physical space where you were bringing people together. And so you went into the real estate business.
I did. I was in my late 20s and I took out a $50,000 per month lease for the top three floors of this old brick building in Oakland. And it was amazing. At one point, we had 120 entrepreneurs in the space, over a dozen startups, you know, hackathons, happy hours. It was and continues to be that community. That's still the foundation of Powerhouse. But about 5 years into it, I was like, I don't want to be a landlord. This is really risky. I don't want to do facilities management. And this model doesn't scale. Like, it's really fun. It's really important. But I want to make a global impact. I want the largest corporations in the world and investors to decarbonize their operations by embracing innovation. And we're just not going to get there with, you know, a couple dozen startups in our physical space or this accelerator program that adds a lot of value, but to such a small number of companies at a given time. And so that's when we decided to make that pivot to what we are today, which is this innovation firm that can connect, you know, global entities with startups that are also global and providing, you know, thousands of different solutions to the thing that we're all trying to do.
Okay, so you went from the physical space to the set of scalable services, right? That's
right.
And that's the first piece of where you started was the service piece, Powerhouse, right? But along the way, you also created Powerhouse Ventures.
That's right.
Where did that start? Where and when did that start? Where are you on that?
Yeah, so that started in, we launched our first fund and started investing in 2018. And it came about because we just realized we were sitting on this treasure trove of data. You know, I mentioned Compass, the trend analysis offering. And we were like, we know all the startups. We know them at the earliest stages. And we know what their potential customers, investors, acquirers, we know what they want. We know what they want to become a customer of. We know what they want to invest in. We know what they want to buy. And so we had the idea that, one, we had this proprietary information. Two, when we started Powerhouse Ventures, there were basically very few, if any, other seed stage climate tech funds, which is hard to believe now because there's so many. But when we started, it was like angel investors and DOE grants. And that was kind of it for early stage companies.
Well, of course, that's because they all went bankrupt. Well, they didn't. I mean, the funds didn't go by there, but the portfolio companies, because of course, when I started in 2004, there were none. And then I remember there was something like at one point there were 1,500 in my database.
Wow.
Investors in either climate tech, clean tech, energy tech, whatever, however you want to define it. And it was hilarious. And I was telling people, this is going to end in tears. This is, I've been there. I lived through the .com. It's all going, oh, no, the penguins. You've got to do it for the children. I'm like, okay, let's wait and see. And sure enough. And then we got the clean tech 1.0 bust. And then that's presumably about
that's where we started.
That's when you started at the bottom of the
exactly,
next
just like Buffett, you know, join when everyone else is leaving. So
it's amazing that it felt like a desert to you because it had been so overcrowded in about 2007-8.
It was, and like you said, it absolutely was. And then, you know, that dip, and so then there were very few other funds, but there's a cohort of us that all started around the same time, like Congruent Ventures, Wireframe Ventures, who we frequently co-invest with. And now, of course, we're back to that. You know, there's many, many, you know, dozens, if not hundreds now. But yeah, so we started it because one, there was a market gap that we could uniquely fill. And two, we had this proprietary set of data and this proprietary network and community that we could tap into. So that's kind of the impetus for starting the fund.
And so fund one, you closed in which year and how big was it?
Fund one, we closed in the summer of 2018, and it was a tiny pilot software-focused seed fund of $7 million. We set out to raise five, and we were very happy with ourselves to raise seven. And it was mostly individual investors, and we made 26 initial investments. You can imagine, given the fund size, initial checks were, you know, 100K, 200K. But we've invested in some pretty incredible companies, some of which are now valued at, you know, $250 million and doing really amazing work. And yeah, happy to mention a few of them if you'd like.
Yeah, no, absolutely. What are your, you know, this is sort of, who are your favorite children is the question. You can't ask any parent, but what are your favorite investments from that fund?
Let's see. So a few that are furthest along. So this is in part just because we invested them early in the fund life, but also a testament to who they are. So, and I think they represent a good diversity of our thesis, which, as I said, is seed stage software focused. Climate technology, mostly in the energy transition and electric mobility space. So the first is called Terrabase. They've closed a Series B, and they provide an interconnected digital and automation platform to reduce the cost and increase the scalability of utility scale solar. They were founded in 2019 by a bunch of SunPower execs who left. They've done 30 gigawatts of large-scale solar projects have used their software, and now they're getting into the robotics and automation space. So yeah, they're currently active on more than 15 gigawatts of solar in 10 countries. They've got over 100 people on the team all over the world, and they've raised over $70 million.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, very cool.
So that's one. Another very different space, but related. They're called Leap. They've also closed a Series B. They connect distributed energy resources, or DERs, to wholesale energy markets. And they've raised $30 million in equity and then more in debt, have about 75 people on the team, half of which are just pure engineers. They've got about 60 distributed energy resource partners, and they're managing about 70,000 devices. So we're talking EV batteries, you know, Nest thermostats, any smart device that can contribute to a virtual power plant, and thus they're aggregating about 700 megawatts of authorized load. So that's the second.
Nearly one big power station worth. That's something.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Which, you know, their whole thing is like, don't run peaker plants if you don't have to. They're dirty, they're expensive. We can do it with distributed energy resources if we aggregate them, you know, thoughtfully through software. And then the last one, also in the solar space, they're called Raptor Maps. They've raised a Series B. And their whole thing is advanced analytics for solar O&M, and they create a digital twin of solar projects. They have analyzed more than 75 gigawatts of solar across 45 countries. They started in 2015. The overall thesis of the fund is we can get to 90% decarbonization of the electricity sector with existing tech. Like, we don't need new tech breakthroughs to do most of what we need to do to decarbonize. Yes, that remaining 10% we got to figure out, and that's, you know, decarbonizing industry and sustainable aviation fuels. But most of the tech we need, we just have to get it to scale. And those are the types of bets that we make.
Okay, Emily, I've got a reputation to uphold here of being difficult. Three great successes in that fund. What are the stupidest investments that you did from fund one?
Wow. I don't know if I can categorize any of them as stupid. There are certainly ones that have been slower.
Have any of them just disappeared? They're just gone?
Incredibly, no. Which, I mean, I think it speaks in part to the value of a software-focused fund is that it's relatively way lower capex. You get relatively higher multiples when you do exit, and exits are relatively faster. So, and margins are higher. So there's a lot that kind of is in our favor in terms of that structure. But we haven't had anyone go under.
No one's gone under, but you do have some zombies. Come on, admit it.
There are some that are struggling, and especially in this market. You know, we started in 2018. It's been nothing but sunshine and puppies in climate tech since then up until recently. And now everyone's experiencing life in a down round. And most of our companies started in this boom time. And so we are spending a lot more time supporting the portfolio versus what we were doing up until, you know, somewhat recently, which is just always seeking new deals and, you know, supporting them. Now it's like, all right, we got to double down and support those that we've backed and make sure that they can get through the hard times if that's the right thing for the fund, or, you know, help them sunset gracefully if it's not. But thankfully, that hasn't been something we've had to deal with yet. But I'm sure we will.
Any exits?
We have had a couple exits. So we have had some early exits out of Fund One. Nothing that's returned the fund. You know, those exits take longer to develop because they need the time to become worth more. But yeah, our very first exit was a company called Ensemble Energy. They were doing advanced analytics for wind operation and maintenance, and they sold to or were acquired by a company called Spark Cognition, which is a global leader in AI. And Spark Cognition had an energy practice, but not a renewable practice. And so they acquired Ensemble early so that they could just have that be a part of their offering. So that was our very first exit, and that was probably a year and a half ago. We've had two others. One, a company called Solstice, a community solar company that sold to Mitsui, and that was about 6 months ago. And then a company called Mobilized, focused on EV charger utilization, and that was acquired by another company called FreeWire Technologies. So those are the three, all good, but all small. But we do track company valuation appreciation.
Right. How's the fund doing overall? You've raised a second fund, which we're going to get onto in a second.
Yeah.
So presumably, overall, you can tell a good story.
Definitely. I think the traction, especially those ones that I mentioned, like Terabase and Raptor Maps and Leap, you know, I think those are indicative of the types of companies that you know, are worth a lot more now. And if and when they exit, are going to be those that really make the fund a success. But even today in Fund One, so we track what was the value of the startups when we invested relative to the value today based on an actual round that has closed.
Yeah.
So not, you know, kind of projections. And so for those that have raised subsequent rounds, which is the majority of them at this point, we've seen a 5.7x valuation growth rate or valuation appreciation, with the top performers being closer to like 10 or 11x. So that's where we are in terms of fund performance to date.
And for those who are not VCs listening, there's a very sort of standard methodology of valuing your portfolio. Of course, you only really know when you actually get the exit and the cash is in the bank, which might take years and years and years and years to get the last bit of cash. But you do revalue based on, if there's another round and that share price effectively has gone up, at that point you're allowed to sort of say, right, I'm doing well. So you're at that point in the proceedings.
And it's worth saying, the company valuation appreciation isn't one of those standard metrics. It's something that we track because we're still early enough in the fund life that, you know, things like multiple on invested capital, which I think is really the holy grail. Sometimes people talk about IRR, which is important, but ultimately I think that is the metric, and, you know, still a little early in the fund life, but on the right trajectory, and the company valuation appreciation is a nice way to see if we're on track or off track. And I think on track based on what we know.
So in my experience as an angel investor and, you know, sometimes VC, is that for the IRR, you either need to get in very early or just before the exit.
Right.
But it doesn't make any difference, because what you really want to do is have money and spend money. I mean, it's cash to cash that really makes a difference to, you know, your lifestyle or to your ability to cause trouble and so on. Yeah.
Exactly. Which is why that MOIC or multiple uninvested capital is really the metric that we're going for.
That is the gold standard. What about Fund Two? So that was Fund One was only $7 million and 26 investments. You've done that. You finished investing that a couple of years ago. Fund Two.
Yeah. So Fund Two, we did a big jump. Most funds, you know, maybe you like 2x or 3x from one fund to another. But because Fund One was so small, we set out to raise $50 million in Fund Two. And there was definitely that valley of fundraising death when we were at about $30 million and we just weren't getting any further. And we were like, this isn't going to happen. We're failures. You know, this sucks. And then lo and behold, you set a deadline and all the LPs decide to join you, which was incredible. And so we ended up having Fund Two being $25 million oversubscribed. So it was a total of $75 million, which, you know, so more than 10x from Fund One to Fund Two, which I don't think will 10x from Fund Two to Fund Three, because we don't want to be, that would be difficult. But also it would take us away from the seed focus, which is what we love most. So $75 million backed by, we wanted at least one of the world's largest corporations to join us as a limited partner investor across all the areas we invest in. So that's energy, the automotive space, utilities, financial services, property technology, and tech. And we somehow miraculously were able to do that. So we brought in Total, Toyota, Energy Impact Partners, which is a $3 billion AUM utility consortium of a venture fund made up of utility investors, Fifth Wall on the property tech side, and then Microsoft, who was our very first investor in Fund Two, and they anchored the fund. And the fact that they came in so early and their credibility, their reputation, I think that made it possible to bring in the rest of the capital. So both the corporate investors, but then also family offices in the U.S., so prominent names from the Walmart family and Hewlett-Packard family and the Schmidt family through their entities, and then a whole bunch of industry powerhouses who, the people who have had incredible exits already, you know, they as individuals have doubled down and said, I want to back the next generation of entrepreneurs and benefit from their upside. I'm going to help you with sourcing and diligence and supporting the portfolio companies. And that's, I think, what makes us so unique is we have many, many investors and a lot of fund managers. When I tell them that, they're like, that must be awful to do that fund investor management. And it's the opposite. We love it. It's so beneficial to us. It is that community that Powerhouse, that's how Powerhouse began.
And I'm very much hoping that when you do get onto Fund Three, I might have found a little bit of cash down the back of the sofa and come in on it.
I hope so.
Fun too. I was really, you kept sending these emails. We're doing a first close. We're doing a second close. Come on, Michael. And I just didn't have the liquidity and I still don't.
Fund Three.
Fund Three. Let's keep our eye on the prize. And how much of Fund Two have you already put to work? And have you already got your favorite children, your favorite star portfolio companies?
Too early for the favorites, but happy to mention a few that are doing great. We've deployed $7.7 million. So it's also incredible. You know, this is just the first year of Fund 2 deployment, and we've already deployed more than all of Fund 1 combined. So that's been interesting. Just, you know, checks now, average check is $1 million or $1.5 million versus the, you know, $150K we were writing out of Fund 1. A couple that we're most excited about that also give a good sense of the breadth of the fund. One of the earliest investments we made, actually the very first out of Fund 2, is a company called Bat Genie. And they use software to dynamically charge and discharge both consumer and EV batteries in a way that optimizes battery health, battery life, battery performance. So pure software play, which hasn't really been done before. There's always been a physical or hardware component to solutions like this. But that's one totally different space, a company called Salient Predictions, which improves seasonal to sub-seasonal weather forecasting. So that 2 to 52 week period, which, as you know, has everything to do with energy trading, but also ag and insurance. And, you know, you need accurate forecasts to do anything in energy well.
So I know Salient Predictions. Talked because one of the people involved is somebody that I got to know very, very well during during the earlier years of New Energy Finance, but I wasn't able to get in on the round. I actually wanted to, I was very interested.
If you had joined Fund 2, you would be in the round through us.
Yeah, well, that's one that got away from me. But I love it because the salient refers to salinity. It's the
exactly
so one of the things they do is they check salinity in the oceans.
That's right.
Based
exactly
on that, they know how much evaporation and therefore how warm the sea must have been. And it keeps them the edge.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah,
and then the last one,
them.
Yeah. They are. They're a phenomenal team. Last one, totally different space. They're called Adaptus in the built environment space, and they help building owners and developers plan for operational and embedded carbon and waste during the design phase. So they can do, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of iterations of design in order to optimize for what building owners and developers care about, which increasingly, either because it's regulated or because they're doing it voluntarily, is about embedded carbon. So those are just a couple examples from Fund 2.
Okay, now, thank you. We've got a few minutes left, and I want to do what you did to me, which is the rapid fire round.
Okay.
I don't know how rapid fire we'll be able to go, because these are some of the kind of areas of, I don't know, I don't want to say controversy, but challenge, mm-hmm. difficulty. There is this huge debate between research versus deploy, right? And mm-hmm. Vinod Khosla wrote a piece in The Economist saying we shouldn't do wind and solar, we shouldn't be rolling them out because mm-hmm. they don't do base load. And we should be doing fusion, and we should be doing small modular reactors, and we should be doing super cooled transmission lines. And I wrote a piece saying, well, actually, none of those things will meaningfully as in more than a few percent, deliver electricity by 2050. And therefore, we have to do what we've already got. So where are you on the Khosla Liebreich scale between deploy nothing and go for the breakthrough, or deploy what we've got? Actually, I'm not the Liebreich position is not actually just deploy what we've got. It's actually deploy, 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 and also prepare for the things that really will be in the 2040s, but certainly in the 2050s, major contributors. So where are you on that?
Yeah, definitely closer to your end of the spectrum, which maybe is why I'm on the show. Although I know you have people on the show who you disagree with, which is great. But yeah, I mean, I'm right there with you. And our whole thesis backs that up, which is we absolutely need both. And anyone who says it's just one or the other, I don't take them very seriously. You know, there are these hot debates on Twitter about it, and I just roll my eyes, because I think anyone who's really in the industry knows, like you said, we need both. But the reality of climate science and the timeframe that we have is we have to get what works deployed globally as quickly as possible. And you do that with software and financial technology. And so that's the whole thesis of our fund, is we don't take tech risk. We don't have to, just get the good stuff out there. You know, we've had government backing for things like wind, solar, batteries, EVs for decades. And that's why solar is the cheapest form of electricity in almost every energy market globally today. We will get there with other tech, but there are other funds and there are government programs, especially here in the US, the ones that we know most about through Office of Clean Energy Deployment and the Loan Program Office led by Jigar Shah, who is absolutely on this train with us, who just, you know, his whole tagline is deploy, and that's what he's enabling. But also DOE is playing the role, Department of Energy is playing the role they should play, which is supporting those breakthrough technologies that do have that 10 to 20 year path to commercialization. We need both, but let's buy ourselves time to get those longer term solutions to market, because that is going to take time, and that's time we don't have. So if we ignore what's working today or don't focus on deployment, I think we're making a mistake and we're losing out on upside. Like, that's where there's less risk and higher, faster multiples, which we're very happy to be leveraging.
Very good. And Jigar Shah, whom you mentioned, was on this show actually before he took over as head of the Government Loan Office. So we'll put a link in the show notes. And Vinod, if you're out there, you're listening, I'm sure you are, and you want to come on the show, you'll be welcome anytime. Just have your people reach out to my people or to me.
Love it. That's great.
IRA versus carbon price. You have to define Klaxon alert on myself. IRA is the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act. Inflation Reduction Act. So
that's right.
Inflation Reduction Act versus carbon price.
You're going to get a lot of this from me, which is the yes and. So, you know, less exciting from a content standpoint. But it's true. It's, you know, ideal world, we have both. And we do. We have the Inflation Reduction Act, and there are many markets, you know, a few in the U.S. and more in Europe that do have a price on carbon. And we've seen the impact of it. You know, there's research that pricing carbon in the EU led to a 10% increase in the number of clean tech patents and innovations since that price has been in place. So yeah, both yes and the fact that IRA is now giving Europe FOMO and the fear of missing out of, you know, onshoring these jobs and keeping them there. That's great. That's the way it should be. That's the way these policies should work, is that we're trying to one-up each other in a way that serves, you know, addressing the climate crisis, but also creating incredible investment opportunities. So yes, I'd say yes and.
Hardware or software? Yes and.
Yes, and of course. And these days, it's really rare that you have one without the other. Even some of the most prominent hardware-focused companies, like we had Mateo Jaramillo from Form Energy on our podcast, What It Takes. And when they started, it was a pure hardware play, but they realized they had, and he talks about this on the show, they realized they had to develop software to help utilities value what they were offering, because what they were doing didn't exist. And so that's now a product that they're able to monetize. So even in what seems like the most hardware-focused of innovations, even they are focusing and building software teams to really optimize the value of what they're creating.
Let me come back on that one, because the VC model is not, well, I should phrase it as a question. Is the VC model ideal for businesses that are hardware-based, or also that inevitably require substantial assets? Back to the question at the beginning of our conversation. You know, when you have a company that fundamentally at some point has to go and build a hell of a big plant, does that company fit the VC model? Yes or no?
Maybe. But I'd say there are so many types of startups in climate, and VC works for some and it doesn't work for others. And this idea that, you know, VC works for all climate tech or no climate tech, it's just not I think it's not that black or white. You know, venture capital, to your point, it requires high reward potential in a specific time frame. And there are certain startups, certainly those that we have backed, that we think will enable that. But there are others that, like you said, just take more time, take more capital, take different types of capital. And so I think at various times in a startup journey, there are various types of capital that make sense or don't make sense. And in the US, we mentioned a couple of the government-focused programs, you know, Office of Clean Energy and Deployment, which is doing not just loans, like Jigger's doing loans, which is great, you know, $1, $2 billion loans at a time, totally incredible. But then OSED, Office of Clean Energy and Deployment, is doing $26 billion over the next 4 years just in grants. Like, you don't even have to pay it back. So those sources of capital, especially for things like direct air capture, sustainable aviation fuels, decarbonizing industry, really important. But there's also entities in the U.S. like Generate Capital, which Jigger was a founder of before he joined the loan program office, and Spring Lane Capital, that provide different types of kind of first of a kind project financing, or when they start to scale up that project finance, before you can get more traditional investors to take that risk. So that industry, you know, didn't exist, what, 10 years ago? But these entities have popped up to kind of fill the gaps between DOE, venture capital, and then kind of later stage, less risk tolerant financing.
I love the way you've described that, because, you know, we talked about how when you started, there was the desert, but before the desert, there was this sort of flowering of venture capital in, you know, clean tech 1.0. And I think one of the big reasons why it almost all failed is so many of the people in it just did not understand anything beyond the venture model. They didn't understand that you had all these other pools of capital that you needed to assemble. They had no expertise in assembling them. They had no understanding that they were even needed. And it was a big surprise to them that hard tech or building, you know, businesses around actual kit and then potentially around even big plants and constructions and so on. It was a huge surprise to them that didn't work just like, I don't know, Snapchat or Palantir or some software play and so on. Right. And it is very different now. You do get people who understand that.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah.
Oakland bias. Is it a thing, and how do you deal with it? You're sitting in, you're sitting in Oakland, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. This is our office in Oakland. That's our headquarters. We do have people now across Powerhouse and Powerhouse Ventures in Toronto, Michigan, Houston, Pittsburgh, Washington D.C. But
you don't have people in Lagos, Kuala Lumpur. I mean, you're not even. Never mind. I mean, you know, Berlin, London.
Right.
But
not yet.
When I say Oakland bias, I'm talking about, you know, there's so much of the world's venture capital is Sand Hills Road. It's California. Right. Very specific and has a very limited outlook on the world in people's view. I wouldn't possibly comment.
No, I mean, I do very much agree with that. I think Oakland, you know, I live here, which is part of the reason the company's here, because you get to do that when you found a company. But it's also, you know, it's sunnier and cheaper than San Francisco, and it's scrappier. And that's a part of our identity is, you know, Powerhouse started with this kind of scrappy DIY community building culture. And that has continued through to today. Like, the reasons our clients love us at Powerhouse and our founders, I think, love us at Powerhouse Ventures is because there is that community focus. And it's not just transactional. You know, venture capital is such a transaction-based industry. And while that is the case, we don't have to be as people. And so in terms of Oakland, I think it is indicative of who we are, which is pretty personable. We're people first. When we're evaluating companies, we're seed stage. We don't have a ton of data to analyze. It's really, who are you as a person? And that's what we figure out really well.
Okay, but you've done something very elegant there. You said, oh, no, Oakland is this tremendous advantage because we have our own culture. I was really coming at it from the perspective of climate is a global problem. And frankly, you know, we are in the developed world decarbonizing. You only have to look at the trends, and you look at the OECD, and we're all over the peak, and we're coming down the other side. We're not coming down fast enough, but we're coming down the other side. And then you look at China, and you look at India, and you look at the big countries in Asia, the Indonesia, Malaysias, the Pakistans of the world. You look at Africa, which is the big coming power in terms of population and hopefully in terms of wealth and lifestyle.
Yeah.
Are you really working on the right, you know, can you address any of that from where you sit?
I think we can in this global world, especially post-COVID, but we were doing deals remotely before because, you know, we're software investors. We don't have to be on site to analyze an opportunity. The fact that at Powerhouse, you know, the fact that the database is already 40% outside of the US at Powerhouse Ventures, the fact that our portfolio companies are working in every market in the world, including those in Latin America and Africa and Asia. I think we feel very capable as a team, you know, and in part, most of us are digital natives and have never known anything other than this, you know, interconnected world. We feel really comfortable and confident doing deals and making connections that are global.
But would you fund a startup in South Africa or in Kenya or in Ghana or in Kuala Lumpur? Would you do that? Or would you say, look, you know, let's be serious here. Mm-hmm. We just can't do our job in this kind of high touch, incubating early stage venture,
right,
with that geographical distance and cultural distance?
Yeah. It's a great question. We have made bets for companies. We want them to be incorporated in established markets, but they can be operating anywhere in the world. And we do have companies whose first market is Nigeria or, you know, other parts of sub-Saharan Africa. And the question we ask ourselves is, can we support them meaningfully? And if the answer is yes, then we will make those bets. But if the answer is no, because we just, like you said, we don't know the market, we don't have the same kind of connections and the ability to offer value to the founder, then we might direct them to others in our network who could do a better job of that. So it's really case by case basis. And, you know, do we see the opportunity for a venture returning company or not? And regardless of where they're operating in the world, we absolutely look at all of those opportunities.
Okay, final rapid fire topic. I've had three VCs on Cleaning Up.
Mm.
Nancy Fund, Gina Damanik, and yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know where this is going. I've also, by the way, I've had some fantastic women, but also men entrepreneurs. But my question to you is, are you going to outperform the guys?
Data says yes. I mean, every study of fund managers and startups, like those with diverse executive leadership, have better financial performance, period. Like, plenty of studies to back that up. And so, you know, data's on our side, but to be determined. That is my hope, though. I hope that the fund, Powerhouse Ventures, is one of, if not the most successful startups in the climate technology space. And, you know, for VC, that means top quartile is like 15 to 27% IRR. S&P is about 10%. So just to give some kind of relative context. But again, the multiple on invested capital, that's really, that's kind of what we're going for.
But if I challenge you, you said that diversity is what brings the results, but you're not diverse. You're almost all women. That's not diverse.
Fair. One of my mentors and advisors pointed that out, and it was really funny. He was like, don't claim diversity. But three women of the team, two of us are partners, myself as managing partner, two men on the team, one Latino man, we have a Native American woman. So when we think about diversity, it is geographic, it's gender, it's nationality, it's language, many elements of diversity that we think about.
And you've got about now 26 investments in the first fund and 7 in the second. So you've got 33 investments. Mm-hmm. How many of them have got women CEOs? Because that was something that I found very hard as an investor to find and invest in women-led companies. When we were doing the Bloomberg New Energy Pioneers, year after year, we would try really hard and have like one or two women out of 10 on the stage when it came to prize giving, when it came to finding the best startups. And we really tried. Do you find that hard, or is it easier now, or where you are?
I'm guessing it's relatively easy compared to how it was when you were doing it, but I think it is still hard and it still requires a lot of intentionality, and it will not happen without that intentionality. So, you know, I think a lot of venture managers want to do the right thing, but if you don't put in the effort, it's not going to happen. And if you don't have a goal and you're not measuring yourself and tracking data, you're probably not going to achieve a goal, especially if you don't have one. So at Powerhouse Ventures, we've said that at least 25% of the investments we make will have a founder that is underrepresented. And that captures not just women, but underrepresented people of color, you know, plenty of Asian, South Asian representation in our portfolio. But in terms of Black, Latino, Indigenous, that is much harder to find. And so that's the goal that we've set. And we're on track for that with Fund 2, that a quarter of the investments that we've made are led by underrepresented founders, which is hard, but we're proud of. And we're excited to have the goal, and we're excited to be on track to meet it.
I love the word underrepresented in this context, because I did lots of work, you know, running Bloomberg NEF, building the Bloomberg NEF summit, and making sure that we had women thought leaders, but I was not switched on to other underrepresented groups. Mm-hmm. And that's a regret, and something that I've, you know, would try to address, because it does encompass so much more than just gender. Is almost, right. It's the sort of visibly easier one, or the one, yeah, that's easiest to start and to talk about, but that journey can't possibly stop there. I also love the word intentionality, because of course in the English language, I don't even know if it exists, but I do know exactly what you mean. You have to really focus on this stuff and talk about it and so on.
Agreed. And it does, I think it helps that because we are women founded and women led, I think we have some competitive advantage, because women want to work with other women, and women investors are more likely to back other women and other underrepresented people. So I think there's some competitive advantage there.
Emily, I've kept you beyond the hard stop time that you gave me, and I apologize for that, but
no,
it's
worries.
Been absolutely fascinating talking to you. Thank you so, so
Thank
much
you.
For your time.
Thank you so much, Michael. I'm really a huge fan of what you do and all the provocative ways you do it. So just grateful to be on the show, and grateful for your listeners to learn more about what we're up to.
Thanks so much. Thank you for joining us.
Of course, you too.
So that was Emily Kirsch, founder and CEO of Powerhouse, and managing partner of Powerhouse Ventures. You'll find links in the show notes to the episodes of Cleaning Up that we mentioned during our conversation. So that's episode 9, dating all the way back to September 2020 with Jigar Shah, episode 18 with Nancy Fund, and episode 47 with Gina Damanik. If you've enjoyed today's conversation, please remember to like, share, and subscribe to Cleaning Up, or leave us a review on your chosen podcast platform. And if you want more from Cleaning Up, sign up for our free newsletter at cleaningup.live, where you'll find our archive of over 150 hours of conversation with extraordinary climate leaders. And why not help someone else learn more about the net zero transition by introducing them to Cleaning Up? Cleaning Up is brought to you by our lead supporter, Capricorn Investment Group, the Liebreich Foundation, and the Gilardini Foundation.